This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Podcast here on the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals and the only place for every New York football team and their fans. Do you believe? I'm your host, Steven Tino Rodriguez, and welcome back to another edition of the New York Football Podcast. You can check us out at Apple Podcast, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and of course, the Believe website. BLEAV.com. Like, download, rate, and subscribe on all platforms. You can also follow us on Twitter at NYFootballPod, as well as myself at Tino Rodriguez. We have an awesome show as always for you guys. This show will be a little different, but at the same time, it's going to be unique as Ryan Dyrud from the LA Football Podcast will join us on the show to help me build the greatest New York football team of all time. We're going to take a look and break down the best coaches and players at each position from both former and current Giants, Jets, Scarlet, and Black Knights. So let's waste no time and get right into it. Let's find out who is a part of the greatest New York football team of all time. All right, now we have on Ryan Dyrud, who has somehow manifested this entire show for me. Ryan, I'll start out before I put it together. I'll say thanks for the tidbit. Obviously, now we talked about this last time you were on, but a lot of the New York Football Podcast does come from the LA Football Podcast. And now just like that, it's clockwork. Here we are putting together a New York, the greatest team in New York football history, I guess you could say. Similar to what you just did a few weeks ago on the LA Football Podcast.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks for running with the idea, first of all. Always love just chatting football with you and going back and forth. And I remember just backtracking a ton after I was doing my show when I saw you come on the network and I had a New York Football Podcast. I was like, great, we need to just do this every city. So a few weeks ago, I had the idea of building the greatest LA football team. And what I mean by that is using all the LA football teams, so the Rams, yes, Chargers, the USC Trojans, the UCLA Bruins, and I'm only using the Rams and Chargers teams that were in LA. So not, you don't get the greatest show on turf teams.
Oh.
You don't get San Diego teams. So the Chargers is a very small sample size. It's basically 3 years. Mm-hmm. And in the Rams, obviously, you're getting rid of those greatest show teams. But then I brought it to you. I was like, hey, that'd be fun if we kind of did a bracket of this. Went city by city. You know, we have some other shows that have, Miami podcast, stuff like that. Or even if we did went to other websites and you were all about it. So you're doing the New York one. I think it'll be fun to hear your team and how they compare to the LA team.
Just for the Miami note real quick, if the greatest team in like Florida history, I think you have to like include high school players. I mean, Florida pumps out talent. You could have done that for California too. I mean, there wouldn't have been enough slots on the team. Some of these states are loaded with talent.
Yeah, it crossed my mind doing that. And I did like last year when we probably the same around the same time when there's just nothing going on. We did a a bracket building the greatest LA high school team, the greatest LA college team, and then we had them all go against each other. So this kind of built off that. Because, yeah, you just wouldn't have enough room if you used all three of them on one.
No, yeah, definitely not. Especially, I mean, for Jersey, too. I mean, we're doing New York here, but Jersey's loaded with high school talent. Yeah. As well, so.
No, for yes. sure.
But now, so I wouldn't say this is off the cuff, but essentially I'm just going to inform the people about how we're going to try to do this. I'm going to list my team. We're going to go position by position. I explained it before we got on here. But we'll go position by position, and you guys will get caught up on kind of what Ryan had for his team, and we'll just kind of give a little banter back and forth on who we think is better. Obviously, we are respected journalists. We will try to not be biased, but I think it will come out at some point. And let's just get started with the head of the dragon itself. We'll start at the quarterback position. And, you know, this one was interesting because I wanted to make sure it was fair. We talked about having two at each position. So I wanted to do at least one giant, one jet. Of course, Army and Rutgers have had some great quarterbacks in their day, but I think New York as the Mecca have had two guys that those teams or the fans of those teams would want any day of the week given the opportunity. We're going to go Eli Manning and Joe Namath.
Yeah.
And Broadway Joe was one where I was like kind of like hesitant because I didn't know if the modern day Jet fan would feel the same way as, you know, most old timers, but they do. I think the pulse of it believes that Broadway Joe calling his shot. Some Giant fans might even think that way too. If you needed a guy to win a game for you, who better than the man who did it himself, you know, called the shot. So Eli, Joe Namath, what say you, Ryan?
Yeah, no, I mean, I figured you may have thrown Mark Sanchez in there, but no, that was an easy pick for those two. Honestly, I thought, because, you know, when we do these things, it's all for fun. So I thought of cheating a little bit because L.A. has a really rich history with football, specifically at the collegiate level, but at least at the quarterback position hasn't been as stacked as New York. And for those of you that don't know, Joe Namath played 1 year for the Los Angeles Rams. So I was like, can I finagle that somehow and throw him on my list because of how great he is? But yeah, you slam dunk for New York teams. I mean, those are the two guys. I don't know.
I have a few positions that are like that. And I was going to bring it up to you when we cross those paths because it's funny. And we'll get to it. But there are a lot of those. I mean, speaking of the quarterback position, Brett Favre. It's like, does Brett Favre count? Well, yeah. I don't think he should. You know, I think. So there was a guy I have here, honorable mention. And this is just, you know, because he's one of the greatest of all times. But my honorable mention was Y.A. Tittle. He didn't spend a majority of his career with the Giants, but that's just a goat of goat, you know, quarterbacks in the NFL. He's a Hall of Famer, Pro Bowler, all pro. I mean, a guy's guy. Winning record, and from what I saw, he had over 33,000 passing yards in an era where you wouldn't even think they were really throwing the ball. So that guy really reinvented the wheel for the quarterback position.
Yeah, that's a great honorable mention. I did something similar. I had my two quarterbacks. I'll just say really quickly, I had Troy Aikman, who many of you might know, but he played at UCLA, was a third runner-up for the Heisman, had a great career for the Bruins. And I had Matt Leinart, obviously one of the best collegiate quarterbacks, didn't have a great pro career, but a phenomenal collegiate quarterback. But my runner-up was Philip Rivers, just because I'm using just that small sample size of Chargers. He only played in LA for 2 years, so I had a hard time throwing him on there when the bulk of his career was in San Diego. But you got to give up to the guy who's going to be a future Hall of Famer.
Matt Leinart over Carson Palmer? Is that a consensus? Is that a consensus?
Not a consensus. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Carson Palmer did win the Heisman. He did go number one overall, but when
he
you have
it first. Didn't he do it first? He did it first, right? He walked so this way Matt Leinart could run, I guess.
Yeah, I think the difference for me with those two, because I went back and forth, was the fact that Matt Leinart won two national championships and was on arguably the greatest collegiate team of all time, where Carson Palmer's Trojans were, you know, it was USC, they were still good, but it wasn't what Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush, what those guys did together. Building just a dominant program.
And now, so just because you said Reggie Bush, and I'm sure that's a position that, and you would appreciate this, LA is loaded at. I had LT as an honorable mention in this next category for running back. He was a guy I was going to bring up. Played for the Jets again for a little bit, a Hall of Famer, but for sure he is on that LA team. I don't even need to look at it. He's got to be somewhere on the bench just – resting his legs. I mean, 24 touchdowns in a season, right? Did I get it right? Or 25? 28 rushing
and
touchdowns.
Three receiving, so 31 total.
31 total. But, I mean, that is bonkers still. Yeah. I don't. And with how the NFL is now, I don't think that's a record that'll be touched for a good amount of time.
I agree. Surprisingly, though, I don't have LT just because he never played in L.A. He was only with the San Diego Chargers.
San Diego, so, I know. But he'll be in the stands. He'll be in the stands.
Oh, he'll be there. He's up in L.A. now. He's at training camp, so he'll finagle his way on the team somehow.
Exactly. He's on the roster somewhere. But now let's go to the New York quarterback, the New York running backs, I should say. And I'll start with a Jet here. And this one, again, was pretty easy because once you have a Hall of Fame resume, it's set in stone. So we're going to go Curtis Martin to start. I think, to head that backfield, I think you got to give the nod to Curtis Martin. He's a stud. A few stats here. 5-time Pro Bowler. An All-Pro, Rookie of the Year in 95. The guy was a 3-down back, 8 seasons with the Jets. Was a beast. I mean.
So good.
Yeah.
Didn't he have not to cut you off, Tino, didn't he only have like one season in his career under 1,000 yards or something like that?
Yes, something along those lines. I don't have it exactly here, but we can put it this way. 168 games played, 14,000 yards rushing. Also, again, in the 90s, you didn't really have – running backs really doing both, running the ball and catching them out of the backfield. He was doing that. 484 reception for over 3,000 yards and 10 additional touchdowns to the 90 he had on the ground. I mean, guy found the end zone like it was no one's business. So we're going Curtis Martin. Now, this one was tough for the Giants side of things. And I didn't do this for every position because, if it found its way there that a Jet and Giant made the team, that's what I tried to do. But I'm going to give the nod over Tiki and over Brandon Jacobs. I'm going to get slack, but I'm going Saquon Barkley. If I want a team that's going to win, I'm putting Barkley as my third down guy behind Curtis Martin. I mean, that's what he does for them. That's his success in the league now anyways. Catching passes out of the backfield and just making the first man miss. I'm taking Curtis Martin, Saquon Barkley as my two-headed monster in the backfield, and I think the rest is history.
I think that's fair. I mean, Tiki had a great career, and Saquon's only 2 years in, but I think we've seen how great Saquon can be. And if he's able to keep what he's doing and stay healthy, he'll go down as probably the greatest Giant running back of all time. Easy. So,
yeah. And it's kind of a preference thing, I think. And I was looking at it more like if I constructed the team, I guess you could say, again, we're not going to have Brandon Jacobs catching passes on third downs. It's like, I kind of looked at it as who's the every down guy and then who's going to be the spellback. That's kind of how I looked at it. Although, what a world if Saquon's your spellback. That would just be.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I hear you, though. I did similar in building my eye. I wanted two running backs that complement each other. And when you look at the L.A. teams, I mean, there's been some good UCLA running backs. There's been obviously some really good Rams running backs. USC, you could make this whole team just off USC running backs, the history they have. But I actually did one USC, one Ram. And I went, obviously, I always preface this. I went simply off play on the field because you always get slack when you hear this name. And I had to go O.J. Simpson. What he did at USC in the 60s, his style, his power, his finesse, phenomenal. So he'd be my power back. And then pairing him with Eric Dickerson, the SMU product that could just run for days, that still holds the record for most rushing yards in a season. I mean, it was hard not to have Reggie Bush on this list. It was hard not to have some of those other great, great names. Marcus Allen is another one, but
that's impossible.
I had to go ED and OJ. Yeah.
Now, just because this is the natural question I always think of when I hear Eric Dickerson, because AP was so close. Adrian Peterson was, I think, like 20 yards or so away from breaking that record. He was really close to that. That's crazy. And then, again, that's another record where it's like he was that close, still couldn't get it. It's almost like, how is that even going to be touched? CJ2K even got close, but.
And he was – when Adrian Peterson, who had a historic year, if you remember, was a year after his ACL injury, and he came storming back like a horse. Yep. But they were just feeding him the ball, trying to get him that record, and it just wasn't in the cards. He came so close. I was pulling for him.
Was Christian Ponder the quarterback, or am I
– It could have been those years. Christian Ponder, Joe Webb,
Joe Webb. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Still, and they made the playoffs, that team did, I'm pretty sure.
Because of AP.
That's it.
All right. So we'll move on to receivers now. This one, there is a USC alum I can guarantee in this category. But I'm going to start. And this one, I guess, could be a tad controversial, but again, not really. I think if you're putting guys on the field and I need a wide receiver one, it's Odell Beckham Jr. And it's not even close, I think, amongst Giants receivers. Granted, yes, he's still young. But being compared to Randy Moss's records, breaking those records as a rookie or your first three, four seasons is insane. If he didn't get hurt his fourth year, he would have had 5 consecutive 1,000-yard seasons out of the gate. All of his first 3 seasons over 10-plus touchdowns, rookie of the year, and the guy is an absolute beast. If he didn't break his ankle with the Giants, who knows? if things will be different, because that team could have been good too. And then it all kind of went downhill when he's your most valuable wide receiving weapon.
Does it still hurt you, the fact that he's not a Giant anymore? I mean, honestly, how it wouldn't, or are you kind of, you're at peace with it now?
I'm at peace with it just because I felt with how the team was and just what they were trying to do. So I talk about this on the show all the time. The Giants with Eli on his last years, they were really trying to make it what the Super Bowl teams were. But as they started losing more and more pieces of those teams, they just weren't that identity anymore. And when OBJ was doing what he was doing, it was very clear they weren't that way. And I think that was the big butting head. They wanted it still like 07. And it's like, buddy, we are a decade ahead of that. So now there was that bad vibe, then the money, and then the on the field stuff. And I think it was time for him to go. I just think he had a lot more success growing in New York than he does in Cleveland, just with his face as a franchise.
Oh, for sure. 100%.
So OBJ, and now this one is you all day. Keyshawn Johnson, first overall by the Jets. It was tough because he didn't play a majority of his career, nor did he really have the most success of his career with the Jets. But I thought going 1-1 as a receiver kind of gave him the nod. 167 total games, over 10,000 yards receiving, 64 touchdowns, over 800 receptions. Guy's a stud. Super Bowl champ, was a big part of that Buccaneers team. With the Jets, 16 games he played for three seasons. Played 11 his rookie year. So best abilities, availability. So when he was with the Jets, produced over 4,000 yards in those four seasons, 31 touchdowns. I mean, any thoughts of how he was as a Trojan?
Yeah, he made my list. So out of my three, he was one of them. And it's hard because I did one Ram, one Trojan, one Charger for my three receivers. Mm. And narrowing down the Trojan receivers, I talked about running backs, but they've had some phenomenal, you know, Roy Williams, Mike Williams, Juju Smith-Schuster as of late, a lot of good receivers. Mm-hmm. Keyshawn, to me, the era he was in, the stats don't look as good as they do for some of the players now. I think Dwayne Jarrett, surprisingly, is like the leading USC receiver, who's a guy who did nothing in the NFL. But what he did at his era, and just the fact that he went number one overall, like you mentioned, that is so rare for a receiver to go number one overall. And it shows how dominant he was for his time, showed the type of receiver. And then the last thing why I loved him is in our generation, Tino, he was the first kind of receiver prima donna that I can remember. The first guy, flashy, was always complaining, he was fun. Now he's in the radio now. He's a great guy. So I love
I'm a big Keyshawn guy, and I always like to, now that he's on the radio, when he was doing NFL Live, he was one of the first people I saw just always have a football in his hand when he was commentating. He always spin it at the end of the segments. He just spin it. That's the funnest thing. If you're a receiver, all you want to do is just spin the football, get the head of it. All right. So now this third one was tough. This was not easy. Army doesn't really throw the ball ever, so we pretty much cancel them out automatically. I had some guys for Rutgers we could have considered. Sanu was there, but really not one of the greatest of all time. So this is ultimately what I gave the nod to. It was between Wayne Krabet and Amani Toomer. That's where I was like, all right, who gets the last spot, a Jet or a Giant? Wayne Krabet has the heart, but his numbers and the statistics don't back it up. Amani was a baller, okay? So 12-year career with the Giants, and he's going to get this third slot, Amani Toomer. 12-year career with the Giants, obviously won the Super Bowl. He had five straight 1,000-yard seasons from 99 to 03. He actually started getting – his numbers just got affected when they just started running the ball more. So that was just a product of what was around him. After 03, it became Tiki, and Eli was shortly after that, and he kind of became an afterthought. But he was their weapon in the playoffs. 07, they beat the Cowboys after losing to them pretty much because of Amani Toomer. He had a huge breakout play that was really just an out route that he took up the sideline. In 10 playoff starts I have, he had 44 receptions for 608 yards, 7 touchdowns. So 7 TDs in 10 playoff games.
Clutch. Yeah. That alone. Yeah, I respect that. What I love about Wayne Corbett, I feel like he just changed the game for short white dudes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He gave a position for short white dudes to come in, and now you see Wes Welker and all these guys, Julian Edelman. That's because of Wayne Corbett, but I respect the Amani Toomer pick.
It's tough. You know, I had to go slot receiver too, so both those guys kind of fit it. Actually, Toomer was more outside. Again, he was their weapon. It's just, I think with those guys, if anything, we move OBJ to the slot. We're going to have some adjustments here. You're going to see. Once we get to the O-line, there's going to be some adjustments.
That's for sure the adjustments.
So tight end, though, was pretty easy. We're only going to go one here, but I do have a second one. We're going to go Mark Bavaro, two-time All-Pro, two-time Super Bowl champ, two-time Pro Bowler, 6 years with the G-Men, 80 games, 266 receptions, over nearly 4,000 yards, 28 touchdowns. Just again, he was a man's man at the position. And the second one's Jeremy Shockey. But I think if you ask any Giant fan what tight end you would ever want, it's Mark Bavaro. I mean, that just rolls back decades and decades. I mean, the guy knew how to ball. It's kind of unfortunate he got hurt the way he did and things ended sour kind of with the Giants. But I think you still take him on your team any day of the week as your starting tight end.
Yeah, I think Shockey has the face value and the name recognition, but
and the hair.
Bavaro's definitely in the hair and the looks and the prowess, but Bavaro's definitely the better pick here. This is where I think we can debate back and forth on which team had the better players, but I think tight end, you know, New York has LA beat. LA, surprisingly, with all the talent they have at every position, tight end was not one of them. I had to go back to the 60s, and I took Hal Bledsoe out of USC, the national championship team, and he's a College Football Hall of Famer, but he played in 1962. Other than that, there really hasn't been any powerful LA football tight ends.
Antonio Gates retired, I guess, before they got to LA. Because he was going until the wheels fell off. He didn't play
1 year, I think, in LA. I just didn't count that as enough.
He's a San Diego Charger.
Yeah.
It's fair. This close, because, I mean, he is one of the greatest of all time at the
position. Totally. Whereas, with my receivers, I didn't list them there too, but one of them, I did choose Keenan Allen because he will play the bulk of his career in LA. He's only 28 years old, so. He's one of the greatest receivers in the game right now.
And, so, I mean, an incredible route runner. That guy is probably the best route runner in the league.
Yeah, underrated.
So now we're getting to the O-line. And this – and I want to start with the center position because this one was the toughest position to – on the O-line to pick some guys to just limit it to one. Guard, there's two. Tackle, there's two. We can only pick one center. And this is what I'm going to go with because I want some RU love on here. Sean O'Hara, three-time Pro Bowler, Super Bowl champ. Played for the Scarlet Knights, won the Super Bowl with the Giants. I'm not saying he's necessarily the best out of all these guys, but I think to represent New York, it's especially with Eli as our quarterback, he'd want his center, you know, to be Sean O'Hara.
Yeah.
Then again, though, Nick Mangold is our runner-up, and what an absolute beast Nick Mangold was.
Yeah,
you don't even need the stats on him.
No, just the hair, everything about it.
Just 7-time Pro Bowler, 2-time All-Pro, but again, this is what I talk about when I talk about Nick Mangold. You ever see his sister? You ever see Nick Mangold?
I haven't, no.
She's a professional weightlifter, an Olympic weightlifter, and she looks exactly like him. And
it's probably just him. He has the same hair, so he probably just plays both sides.
Probably twins. But the point is, I wouldn't want to go against either of them on the other line. Just man's, the both of them, the Mangold's family.
They Mangold people. So.
He also played 10 seasons, all 10 of his seasons with the Jets, which I think was another thing on this list that was important. I feel like, again, playing the entirety of your career is important to make this list. Also, we had all, of course, this is what made it difficult too. Mel Hine, he's someone who played decades ago, someone I haven't seen tape on. But again, as an honorable mention, you got to pay respect. Hall of Famer, 4-time Pro Bowler, 5-time All-Pro. Won 2 NFL championships. That's how long ago this was. And you would like this stat. Mel Hine also coached 3 games for the Los Angeles Dons.
The Dons. Yep. I want
them
back.
Want to bring them back up. Just get the franchise rights. I'm sure they can't be that much money.
Yeah, you never know. We'll see.
Who'd you have at center there?
I went Bruce Matthews, which is Clay Matthews' uncle, I believe. Played center at USC, played all of his professional career with the Houston and Tennessee franchise, 9-time All-Pro, 14 Pro Bowler, and he's arguably one of the greatest centers in USC history. So just a dude's dude, and he's like the one. Your list might be similar. I did a lot of kind of shuffling. I maybe moved some tackles to play guard, but he's the one true center guy. He did play some guard also, but he's like a true center at USC. So
just to get it out of the way, so I'll go to guards. Kevin Mawai is a center, Hall of Fame center, but was drafted as a guard.
There you go. That's all you need.
We're going to get him in at the guard position just to make this line really beefy, but – just Kevin Mawai, real quick, 8-time Pro Bowler, 3-time All-Pro, Hall of Famer. Played center with the Jets for 8 seasons. And then we're going to go on the other side with Chris Snee, another member of the Giants Super Bowl runs recently. 4-time Pro Bowler, All-Pro, 2-time champ, but he played his entire 10-year career with the Giants, which is important.
Yeah, yeah, the great picks there. For guards, the LA team, I went with Ron Yari. All these guys are probably ones not a lot of people know, but Ron Yari, USC. He was actually the first overall pick in his draft, which is very rare for a guard to go first overall. Did play some tackle as well. He's in the Pro Football and the College Football Hall of Fame. Played the bulk of his career with the Vikings. He also played, though, 1 season with the Rams. So he has a little bit of a USC and Rams lineage there. And then my other guard, which I had fun with, Ron Mix. Maybe you've heard of him. A Hall of Famer. Amazing player. Played at USC, but I thought this was cool, too. He was drafted by the Los Angeles Chargers in 1960. So one of the first members of the Chargers franchise. So he has true LA roots there. And Ron Mix, great player.
Yeah, I mean, you got to draft him on the team just for that reason alone.
Totally.
Got to make your starting lineup.
Yeah.
Tackles was a little bit easier just because the Giants haven't been good at tackle in almost like 6 decades. So that's, you know, always easy. But we're going to go – I'll start with – I guess I'll put him on the right side just because the other guy was more of a pure left tackle. Roosevelt Brown, one of the greatest Giants in history, ended up being an actor towards the later end of his career. But Roosevelt Brown, Hall of Famer, 9-time Pro Bowler, 6-time All-Pro, NFL champ, spent his entire 13-year career playing tackle for the Giants.
Love it.
Huge, huge, huge person. Also made our Giants we'd most likely want on our side in a fight. He joined that list as well. So he's a 2-timer on this.
That's a good list.
Look up Roosevelt Brown. You want that guy on your side.
Oh, he's a dude. Yeah.
And then I got DeBrickashaw Ferguson showing some Jet love. Staple left tackle for the memorable Jet years, at least for me, was that offensive line defending or blocking for Mark Sanchez. And DeBrickashaw was the staple of that. 3-time Pro Bowler. Really didn't have the accolades to match how important he was on that team.
Oh, yeah.
But spent his entire 10-year season with the Jets and was just a security blanket on the left side of that line.
Yeah, and one of the greatest names in football history, DeBrickashaw. Like, that is the name of an offensive lineman. You just got that brick wall at the tackle position. Yeah, but you're right, though. He didn't get the accolades that he deserved because he was so important and integral to that team. For the LA team, tackle for me was hard. And, you know, sounding biased here, but there's been a lot of really good tackles in LA football history. The easy choice at left tackle is Jonathan Ogden. You might not know this, he played at UCLA. A lot of people might know that, but he is arguably probably the greatest tackle in NFL history. Hall of Famer. I don't need to talk much about him. Played his whole career with Baltimore, but great guy. And then at right tackle, I went with Anthony Munoz. Obviously, people remember him for being a Cincinnati Bengal, but he played at
one time.
Huge dude.
Huge. Gigantic.
Gigantor, yeah. Played at USC. He's on a lot of people's lists as greatest offensive lineman of all time.
He's NFL 100, too. I think he made that list as well.
NFL 100. So if any of your listeners are wondering why Orlando Pace wasn't on this list, he was a St. Louis Ram. So that's the only reason why. Otherwise, Pace would have been on here. But you have Jackie Slater, who was great for the Los Angeles Rams. So he was like kind of an honorable mention. But just too many good tackles to put them all on there. So it's got to be Ogden and Munoz, though.
My only honorable mention, and this is funny because he didn't play tackle until he left Army, but he is currently the left tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Alejandro Villanueva.
That's right.
A tight end at Army, switched over just because of, again, Army is a running team. He was a blocking tight end, pretty much a lineman. It's what they, as a high school coach, I try to tell my players that, you know, that's how football is played. You know, just everyone wants to catch passes, but to have a guy who's willing to do that and to see it translate to the next level is always encouraging. You know, it's teaching tape for younger kids that it does pay off. You can be athletic and be on the offensive line.
100%. That's a fun fact. I did not know that he played tight end in college. So
yeah, he was good. He actually caught a touchdown pass for the Steelers 2 years ago. The guy's really athletic, but you know, just to talk about linemen real quick, too, because this is how my coaches convinced me to play guard in high school. When you really think about it, the offensive linemen are probably the most athletic people on the field. It doesn't seem like it because they don't have the nice start or runoff as a running back or a receiver does, and they don't dazzle you as a quarterback. But people that size to move and defend defensive ends coming at them and just these big behemoths on the defensive line, it's one of the most difficult things I could think of. I mean, yeah. I was looking at Chase Young
This is a rookie coming in, and you got your veteran left tackle. He's still got a job to do. They get younger. He's got to continue to work. He's got to continue to be the person he is. So I give credit to tackles in the NFL. That shit is not easy to play.
No, not at all. Probably the most difficult position, especially the transition from college to pros. Everyone talks about quarterbacks, but I think tight ends and offensive linemen, that's the hardest transition to truly make.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a tight end, to try to tell a more – like Evan Engram, he has this issue all the time. He's more of a receiving tight end and all that good stuff. But if you kind of get told that as a rookie and you don't develop those blocking skills, still to this day, I mean, he's now a seasoned NFL pro and he struggles with blocking. The sooner you get to that and start working on it, and he has been working on it in years past now, but the sooner the better, because that shit is not getting any easier anytime soon. I mean, you need to make contact ASAP.
And you see the edge rushers, you want to have your tight end block those edge rushers. Good luck.
But then don't tell the Giants that, because last year they left Evan Engram on an island against defensive ends constantly, and like Daniel Jones led the league in fumbles.
There you go, Danny Dimes.
So speaking of defense, though, Ryan, we're gonna switch over. And this part was fun. This part was, it was, I think the secondary made it more difficult, but the Giants in particular, and the Jets are going to be in this list too, but the Giants are a defensive franchise. I think if you really break this down, they have some of the greatest defensive players in history, let alone of the franchise, just on this list. And we'll start DNs. And this was very difficult. There was some bias in this, but so I could go Giants, Jets here and throw my honorable mention. I mean, I really wish there were three defensive ends because it would be a lot easier. But Strahan's going to be my one. I don't need to really elaborate.
No, simple. Yeah, done.
Turn on Good Morning America and just look at him. Look at him smile at you.
Look at that face. He's deserved it. So,
I mean, just to note though, because I think this is the tidbit leading into my next one. He has the single season record for sacks, 22 and a half in his. He played 15 years with the Giants. Again, that was a big part of it, as if it didn't make the cut. But the 22 and a half sacks leads into Mark Gastineau, who's our second defensive end on this team. And that was Mark Gastineau's record. And recently, Gastineau actually spoke up, because there's a clip when Strahan broke that record. They say that Favre, it was against the Packers. Mm-hmm. They say Favre took a fall to give him the record, just because everyone was, I believe it's Monday Night Football or Sunday Night Football, and everyone was watching for that reason. It was late in the game. So Gastineau is my second, just because I think you got to pay respect to it, the fact that it was his record. Before it was 22, his record. So he's only off by half sack. And the year before that, he had 19. He played his entire 10-year seasons with the 10-year career with the Jets. He had 74 sacks in 100 games. That was something I also noted with Strahan. 142 sacks in 200 games. I mean, it's every game. They're getting a sack every game, just about.
Yeah, behemoths, both great.
Before I go honorable mention, who were the defensive ends? And again, you got some good ones, I think, over there. The defensive linemen on the LA side aren't too bad, so I can't wait to
hear. Yeah, and I'll just, full disclosure on this, I won't say my tackles yet, but I actually went all Rams on this. I know that shows some disrespect to I didn't go Chargers. Obviously, they have some great ones now. They've had some good in the past, but those were mostly San Diego, and the Chargers just kind of getting going. Mm-hmm. And USC's obviously had some good ones. UCLA's had some good ones. But when you hear these Rams ones, I don't think how you could argue. But so my ends, I have Jack Youngblood and Deacon Jones, who the fact that they played together is unbelievable. Deacon Jones, you mentioned Strahan sack and their records. And Deacon Jones, had they actually been recording sacks for most of his career, probably would have held that record and still held it to this day. But he is the reason why we even have the sack as a stat, because of what he did to quarterbacks and what he did to opposing backfields. And Jack Youngblood, another awesome dude. I actually had him on my podcast. Awesome guy. Super fun. He lives down in Florida. He's got that great Southern draw. Here's a fun little fact for you and your listeners. You know how Gatorade, the drink, was founded at the University of Florida?
Yep.
Jack Youngblood went to the University of Florida during that time when they were testing it. So he was one of the guinea pigs, if you will, testing Gatorade before it became an actual product. Wow. And now is like the drink that all athletes drink. So Jack Youngblood, not only a fear to quarterbacks, but a staple in the drink market, if you will.
In the Gatorade game. Wow.
Yeah.
So my honorable mention on here is OC Umenyura. And I think it was And so I went rogue with my defensive tackle position as well, kind of just trying to incorporate all the Giants. But OCU Mignora and Justin Tuck, who's going to be my defensive tackle pick, it was unique, and I wanted to have some free range when I did this, because in 07, when they beat the Patriots, I think the most fascinating thing, and if you rewatch that Super Bowl ever, you'll see it. They were one of the first people to really do NASCAR packages, where you had these freakishly just long arm, strong, fast defensive linemen. And they were all pretty much defensive ends, like Tuck was, who was a rookie that year. But you were just able to put him inside the gaps at guard and center. And it was such a problem for the Pats. And that Pats O-line was very good. That team was very good in itself. So I gave the tidbit. It was very hard for me not to just say the entire 07 defensive line, because it obviously proven to be an X factor in drastically changing this franchise's kind of face. You know, they win since the 90s. And if it wasn't for that defensive line in that game, there is no way the Giants are pulling that out of their ass. Tuck, Umenior, and Strahan. I'll take that any day of the week. And again, I'm trying not to do that. So that's why I put Gaston out. But that's what we're looking at. And I also have here, so Tuck, just some stats on Tuck real quick. He two-time Super Bowl champ, obviously. So he was their big – so he played D-end on the second Super Bowl run. So obviously that's what he ended up playing mostly. But 9 of 11 season with the Giants, 60 sacks in 90 games. And then I threw in at the tackle, just because he's a newer guy and he played for both franchises, Snacks Harrison, still in the league. Don't think he signed, but went from the Jets, made the All-Pro team with the Giants. Pretty interesting. Must have been nice for him if he had real estate, because he didn't really have to move boxes very far playing in the same stadium.
Totally. Yeah, that's an easy one. And then he had some good years in Detroit. And I don't know where he is now. I think he is unsigned.
Yeah, because, he's looking for money.
Did he sign with Cleveland? I feel like I can't remember. He might be with someone. But yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head.
But now, so I was wrong with LT just because of the location. But there is no way Aaron Donald is not the starting D tackle on your team, right?
Correct. Yeah. I had to go Aaron Donald.
Okay. I was just making sure.
Technically drafted in St. Louis still, but yeah, he's the staple of this entire team. He's the face of the franchise. He's on the Rams all decade team. They already announced, or he's considered the Rams' greatest decade player in this whole decade. So I got to go ahead and Aaron Donald. And then I also went Merlin Olsen back in time also. As much as old Rams fans love Deacon Jones, they love Merlin Olsen just as much. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about the two without the other. And the fact that Merlin Olsen, Deacon Jones, and Jack Youngblood, all kind of how you talked about, Tuck, Osamura, Strahan play together, Youngblood, Olsen, Jones all play together, and you throw in Aaron Donald to that, good night. Yeah,
and just to clarify, we're going to run a 4-3 defense. So, again, we'll do Gaston out and Strahan, and then I'll just throw Tuck and Umenior on the inside, and I'm fine with that. That is okay with me. I don't want anyone after this like, dude, you only pick three. Just clearing it up. That's my defensive line, and I'm sticking to it.
There you go. Love it.
Linebackers, another position where, I mean, it speaks for itself. The Giants, arguably, in the 80s to 90s, had two of the greatest linebackers to ever play the game on the same team. Again, it just happened to work that way. So, LT, Lawrence Taylor, possibly the greatest defensive player of all time. Then Harry Carson, who is actually a guy, when I was playing middle linebacker, I watched a lot of tape on. Now, the funny thing I also learned about these guys, and I thought it was funny with Lawrence Taylor, because I was looking at his stats, forced fumbles weren't kept track of until past his heyday. Mm-hmm. And naturally, you'd think with the amount of destruction Lawrence Taylor was able to cause and the fumbles that he was able to cause, there would have, been a plethora of it, but there was none. And so I was like, oh, well, so they must have not kept statistics. So I'm sure he was a big part of forced fumbles being kept, because he did not make quarterbacks' blind sides very comfortable ever.
Yeah. If you could also throw broken limbs into a stat category from him too, probably.
Yeah, Theismann. I try not to bring it up because I'm sure he gets it. I'm sure he gets it often. But I do like to note here, he was the defensive player of the year and defensive rookie of the year at the same time in 1981, which is bonkers. Just think about if that happened today. Nick Bosa, I guess, was pretty close. They considered him. But you got to really
trying to think back. There's been a few close ones. I think Derwin James may have been kind of close, but it's very rare.
I mean, you got to have the complete package. He had, and again, he was an outside linebacker, but 132 and a half sacks in 184 games. Nuts. 10 and a half plus sacks for seven straight seasons, including 20 and a half in 1986. That's dumb. And then Harry Carson, his stats aren't as sexy, but again, if you put on Harry Carson's tape, and I did find a nice sexy stat, but if you put on his tape, again, you have Lawrence Taylor on the outside, so everyone's just trying to run away from him. Harry Carson was the perfect counter to that because you just stop everything coming up the middle too. So it's like, pick your poison. What do you want to do? So Harry Carson here, here's the stat. He between 1981 and 1987, Harry Carson totaled 856 tackles. 627 of those were unassisted, which is wild in the NFL, and held opponents over that seven-year span to 3.5 yards per carry, which they said was probably, at the time, the lowest ever, because the average yard per carry in the NFL is typically 3 yards. That's the goal. So, I mean, that's not the average, I should say. It's the expectation. So that's a part of the downs. So carry the ball 3 yards per down, you'll get really close to having a first down. That's why you want to get over that margin, 3.5. So that's how it works. But against him, you're getting the bare minimum, which is, again, a tip of, you know, tip of the cap to him and how good he was.
Yeah, impressive.
Lastly, Jonathan Vilma. There's a shout out.
I was hoping you had him. Yeah, I feel like it had to be Vilma.
But now then, so he's also a fine line. So it's got to be Vilma because he got drafted by the Jets, but he did have most of his pay dirt with the Saints and actually ended up playing more years with the Saints. But Vilma for sure is the other inside guy, which again, if the linebacking core is Taylor, Carson, and Vilma, I don't know what you're going to do very much as an offensive coordinator. But Vilma, just to throw love, when he was with the Jets, he was an 04 rookie of the year. So that definitely helps.
Yeah.
He played four seasons with them, but was a captain of that defense when the Saints won. So that, again, credit to him on how good he was. He had his career highs with the Jets in 05. 128 solo tackles, 173 total tackles.
Cool.
Crazy numbers. Yeah.
107. That is
crazy.
That's still a lot. What, when Darius Leonard won Defensive Player of the Year, what, he went with like 140 something, which was crazy.
Yeah, it's not just
70 is insane. Yeah.
But it's a very, again, I think in going through all of this, you see how different the generations really are, and statistics that used to matter and now they don't really matter. And just,
well, in the linebacking position is just so different. You don't have those true linebackers anymore. Like Vilma was a true linebacker in the sense of, you know, smash mouth guy, would plug holes when he needed to, wasn't really utilized too much in coverage, but could do it if asked. Now you need these big athletic guys that are running 4.4 40s and can play out of the box at safety if they need, or even have a safety come down and play in the box. So it's just a very different defense now.
And a big part of it, I mean, especially at the linebacker position, you know, back in the day when you used to run a fullback, so this is the importance to having two good inside linebackers. And if anyone runs this offense against this hypothetical team, you're in trouble, because to take on a fullback is probably the hardest part of stopping the run, because if the fullback can get a full head of steam, jack up that linebacker and turn his hips the right way, that's how the hole creates. So you don't really see that anymore, thus creating less tackles for linebackers to get. You're not going to – you're really getting read RPO stuff nowadays that are outside of runs, which is thus creating more tackles for guys like Jamal Adams, Derwin James, downhill safeties, more, you know, even Jabril Peppers on the Giants. That's why those guys are getting up and up on leading the team in tackles compared to, you know, what linebackers used to be doing. So
yeah, 100%. No, that's a good tidbit. So if you want to hear my three linebackers, I went 4-3 also, obviously having four defensive linemen. So I did as my Sam linebacker, Eric Kendricks had a great career at UCLA. If you look at UCLA linebackers, arguably the top two would be Eric Kendricks and Anthony Barr. And ironic, they both end up playing for the Vikings too. Yeah. But I gave Kendricks the nod. Love what he did there.
He still have the flow.
He's got the flow. Yeah, he's got the great set of hair. So
love a good flow.
I'm surprised he's not doing a Head and Shoulders commercials yet with Paul Amalu, but. Anyway, so Kendrick's there. At my Will linebacker to the outside, I went with a guy named Richard Wood, probably lesser known guy, played at USC. But a fun fact about him, of all the great backers that come out of USC, you have Clay Matthews, Brian Cushing, the best one, which I'll get to here in a second. He's the only three-time All-American of that entire group. And the time he played, you couldn't play varsity as a freshman. So he only played junior, senior, sophomore, senior year, and he could have played as freshman, been a four-time All-American. He was good enough. And the fact his name is Richard Wood, nicknamed Dick Wood. Come on now. Just got to have Dick Wood on the playing the Wilson.
Just, of course. Yeah. I'm not going to make any comments, of course.
Just leave it there.
Just let it be.
And as my middle linebacker, my Mike, I couldn't get him because he played for San Diego, but he played for USC too. So Junior Seau, probably top five linebacker of all time, RIP. I don't think he touches LT, but he is still a top five linebacker, just what he meant to the SC Trojans, what he meant to the NFL community, and just a savage dude. So awesome. So that's a good linebacking core too. It'd be a tough call between those two, LA and New York.
Well, that that Patriots team, you know, I talk about how good the Giants defense was in that 07 Super Bowl. That Patriots defense was nuts too. I mean, on paper, if you really look at the studs that they had, a young Vince Wilfork, Seau, Brewski, you had Woodson back there, and just, or not Woodson, Harrison, but
Harrison.
Yeah, Asante Samuel was just like a throw-in piece, and Asante Samuel was a very good corner at the time.
Yeah, yes, he was.
Yeah. But now, perfect segue. We're going over to the corners. It started easy, then it got a little difficult, but I made it work. We're going to go with here the no-brainer, Revis Island. Arguably, in at least my generation, the stardom and just let him do his thing corner for any team. I mean, Revis Island, you had nothing but confidence with this guy through his early careers with the Jets. Let's see, 8 seasons with them, so I'd say at least 6 of them starting his rookie year, you just fully knew that he was going to shut down your number one receiver and hold him under 2 receptions and 30 yards. And it was, I always think of the one CG that they had of just like the guys he had ran through. It was like he versed Randy Moss 2 times a year. Andre Johnson, whoever it was at the time, Calvin Johnson, those, you know, the old heads of receivers, and he would just shut them down. And I mean, you don't need anything more other than 4-time All-Pro. He won a Super Bowl, luckily, with the Pats. But 25 intos in 100 games played with the Jets, won every 4 games. That's ridiculous. And then on the other side, this was difficult. And luckily, the only notable Giants corner that I could give credit to is Jason Sehorn, who, yes, gave hope to white people to play positions.
Yes, he did. Yes, but, he did.
Yes, but his statistics don't match it. So we have to lean with an RU alum. And this was even harder because it's like, how do I split brothers apart? But we're going to go with Devin McCourty. Although he doesn't play the most corner of the two twins, he does have the Pro Bowls to show for it and an extra Super Bowl to his brother, and is an RU alum. So Devin McCourty and my runner-up is Jason McCourty. I don't mean to pick sides, guys. If you're listening, I'm just trying to do my job. Just trying to do my job, all right? I love you both equally.
Cool. I mean, you have it locked down with Darrell Revis right there. So that's all you needed. So it was so good. It's kind of a bummer that – I don't want to say his career ended badly, but he really fell off the last few years. And you wish he would have just walked away when he was on top because he was so, so good. And then his last few years, I remember Revis Island became like a joke. Like, oh, everyone's invited to Revis Island now. It's a party on Revis Island. Like, it makes people forget how good he truly was because he was dominant.
Why that started. You don't really see that, and I think the only thing comparable to it for a little bit, and I don't want to toot his horn too much because he does it himself enough, but Josh Norman had that streak of just shutting, you know, the top guys down, but he did it a completely different way than Revis. Revis was not outspoken like that. He was not in your face. He let his game do the talking, and I mean, it was impressive what he was doing during those consecutive back-to-back AFC championship runs for the Jets.
Yeah, so good, so good.
Yeah,
for LA, it was its corner was a hard position for LA teams too. Surprisingly, not a lot of really great, a lot of good corners, not a lot of great corners. I did this on my show. I had my buddy on do it with me, so we just did 2 separate LA teams, and he actually chose Jason Sehorn as his corner because he played some time at USC after starting off at a junior college. So nice. I thought that was kind of fun. So I went with Casey Hayward, played for the Chargers, started his career in Green Bay, but he's underrated corner. The game, I think he's, you know, easily top 10. You could debate if you want to go top 5, but he's a really good shutdown corner. Just doesn't get the credit I think he deserves. Part of that, I think, is just because he plays for the Chargers. So we try to give him love out here on the LA Football Podcast. And the other one, he's had a decent NFL career so far. Maybe not as good as his college career, but Adoree Jackson at USC. He won the Jim Thorpe Award. He was an All-American, a sprinter, just a speed guy. He does it all on special teams. And now he still is a very good player for the Titans, drafted in the first round. But he is definitely the best corner in USC history, and I think the best I could find in LA football history too. So
his special teams were sick on USC. I remember him when he was taking back those punts. Guy's fast.
Yeah, it was like he was the best special teams guy since Reggie Bush, I think, in that era. So, which is saying a lot.
He played at the same time as Juju, right? They played around the same time.
I think they may have been the same draft class. Adoree went 31 overall and Juju went in the second round, I think.
I remember I always used to confuse them when they were playing. Because, I mean, Juju would take back punts, too. And that was the thing. Juju was pretty sick in his USC heyday, too. I mean, when he went off, he went off. It's funny. Yeah. I pulled up the Saquon run when Penn State played USC in that Rose Bowl when they scored like a billion points. Saquon had a crazy run. Juju went off. But Saquon, too, was – and no one will believe it if you look at him now – but was returning kickoffs for Penn State, which you would never see. But, you know, I love college football for that reason because you get your best players the ball however you can, and that doesn't necessarily translate to the NFL. Sometimes it just gives you more headaches. But in college football, it's like, this is our All-American. He's – get the ball in his hand.
Right, we don't have any money investment other than a scholarship. We don't like. I don't want to sound callous, but we don't care if this guy gets injured. Just give him the rock as many times as possible and see what he can do.
Well, I just remember too when the Giants would send Odell back on punts because everyone used to say that. Well, he did the same thing at LSU and they were struggling to find a punt returner. And it's like, you got to protect the investment. But honestly, when he was back there, sometimes when the guys get in the NFL, I feel like they try to do too much and they forget punts are no joke. Punts are serious business.
I was a punt returner in high school. No fun.
It is a very big skill to track the ball. Like, if you don't maintain complete focus, you are going to fumble it. Not only that, you have a decision to make. You have a business decision to make when those guys are running at you. So, it is not to be taken lightly.
No. And usually, punt returners like myself are not necessarily the biggest guys. So, you're just getting pummeled back there. So, I hated returning. But I used to – every time I was like, please go for it. Please go for it when it's coming to fourth down. It sounds so like a non-competitive thing to say as me being a competitor, this football player. And I'd be like, just go for it. Just go for it. And then we'll hold them on fourth down. Like, I don't want to be back there for this punt return.
Well, punts in high school are a nightmare because long snaps are no guarantee. It's a mess. It's a mess. It gives coaches a nightmare every time, you know, you got to think about it. So let's switch to safeties. We're making good time. We're going to switch to safeties. This one is going to sting for Jets fans. This one's going to sting. And I'm going to throw another tip of the cap to the young fella out there, but we're going to go Jamal Adams here just because I think that's the strong safety I want. Someone downhill to fill that box with what's LT at this point and Strahan. Again, I don't think you're running the ball very much. You better take your shots at Jason and Devin McCourty. But Jamal Adams, obviously still very young, 2 years in the league, but a Pro Bowl for both, all pro last year, he has 28 tackles for loss in 46 games. So he's constantly in the backfield. Two picks, six forced fumbles, a TD from both a recovery of a fumble and an interception. And he added 12 sacks on top of all those things. So we got Jamal Adams.
I'm sure you've, not to cut you off, Tino, I'm sure you've talked about this extensively, but can they mend that relationship or is his days as a Jet probably done?
I think it's done. I've been saying it, but I don't think it had to be that way, to be honest, but it's a head coach problem in my opinion.
When are they dumping Gase, man? That's the worst.
It's an issue when the first thing I heard that he was talking to, so it was, I want to say 2 months ago now, but he was FaceTiming Gary V, who's obviously a big time.
Oh yeah.
That guy. So they were FaceTiming. It was towards the draft actually. And he was talking about how, you know, he loves his game, this, this, and that. And how he wants him to stay. And he's just talking about Jamal Adams was talking about Joe Douglas. He never mentioned his head coach. Didn't mention his DC. He's like, dude, I love Joe Douglas. And like, that's great and all, but he's a first-year GM, and your coach is there longer. It's just he should be the middleman. He should be the one getting the relationship with the GM better. It shouldn't be vice versa. If he doesn't want to play for the head coach, you can want to play for the GM all you want, but if the guy on the field calling the plays is someone you don't support as a leader, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Not at that level.
No, dude, and it kills me. And no bias aside, but I love Sam Darnold, and I think as long as Gase is there, he's never going to reach his full potential. And so I hope they get things sorted out and move on from Gase. I mean, he hasn't had any success anywhere. I don't know how he's still an NFL head coach.
It baffles me. And not only that, so it was Lev Bell first. And the fact that Lev isn't gone yet is shocking to me. I thought this would happen first. But it makes sense. Like, I don't blame Jamal Adams for asking for the money that he does. Because naturally, if you're the best at your position, obviously you saw Mahomes' contract. So it makes sense. You know, you want to get paid and reset the market at your position with the way the league's going. But not only that, you're counting on him to cover up holes on that defense. He's what made that defense extremely good. I think he's not oblivious to his surroundings. I think he knows the Jets are a dumpster fire, and I don't think he minds being there to be the face of the dumpster fire. I think there's potential there. He just feels he needs to be compensated for it, and yeah. I don't think that's crazy. For the Jets to come in and lowball him and basically tell him he's not the face of the franchise with that, when he is, I just think that's almost more disrespectful than him being a diva and asking for money when he still has time on his contract. That part of it just doesn't hit me the same as he deserves what he's demanding for, at least in that situation.
Last thing, I feel like I'm just hijacking your podcast here, but
not at all.
Where do you rank him among safeties? Because I know, obviously, I'm a huge Justin Simmons guy, being a Bronco fan. Obviously, Derwin James is exceptional out here in LA. Do you rank him number one? Do you put him, you know, Tyrann Mathieu?
So, I mean, listen, and again, this is recency bias because he was an all-pro at the position, but I think he is the best strong safety in the league. I'll definitely say that. Free safety, you know, him in coverage, I guess, can use some work. But, again, with how the NFL is, and I think for what he does at that position, it's not easy to find. I like to bring this up, too, because the Giants had something similar. They had a very similar situation with Landon Collins. He made an all-pro. He felt the same way. But the feeling I have with Jamal Adams is not the same as Landon Collins. Jamal Adams is the complete package. Granted, he can grow, like I said, at the free safety position a little bit, like rolling back. But for what he needs to do, he's the best at it. Landon Collins was also a downhill safety, had an incredible year. But the repetitiveness to it, the consistency wasn't there. Jamal Adams is a motor. I mean, that guy is the captain of your defense. And you just don't really see that at the safety position like nowadays. I just always think of Ed Reed and just it's top down on defense. I don't know how you feel. I mean, you got Derwin James over there too, but it's got to be top down. You could have a great D-line, but if you don't got someone overseeing everything in the back that knows what's going on, it becomes a lot harder to play defense.
No, it's so important. Yeah, and especially with how rare it is to run your base packages nowadays on defense. So much nickel, so much dime. We saw the Rams this year who already have Taylor Rapp and John Johnson. They drafted two more safeties in the draft, even though they don't necessarily need one because you need to utilize that position. It's so important. So, yeah, I agree with you. Jamal Adams is, you know, you could argue 1A, 1B, him and Derwin. You know, he's going to get paid somewhere. It's not the Jets.
It just – and to me, too, I think a lot of it – and it is what it is, but it's bullshit sometimes. The way the NFL – it's just very nitpicky for me. Like when certain teams and certain situations are just like, well, we shouldn't pay him because this team didn't do this or this team didn't do that. The Giants were saying the same thing. Well, we can't pay Odell because – no, you're your own organization. You're your own franchise. Everything is different for each team. Like who you drafted – just because a player ends up being decades above what you thought he was at the age he's at doesn't mean that's any excuse to not pay him. It just doesn't make any sense to me because most of the time I hear these talks and it's because they're just trying to save their asses because they got the rookie deal. And it's like, give the man the money. Give him money. He deserves it.
And it's funny how finicky, you know, I never like to talk bad about fans. That's what we are. Essentially, we're fans. But it's crazy how fans will say that at one moment, like, pay the guy, he deserves it. And then once they do, if they regress even a tiny bit, what do we think? I mean, you look at the Rams for it. They paid everyone. Gurley, Brandon Cooks, Aaron Donald, Jared Goff, all these guys. And all of a sudden, fans are like, well, what are we doing? We have no cap. We overpaid Goff. Goff's this. He's not what he's supposed to be. Look at blah, blah, blah. Well, it's like, okay, we're all pounding the table. Pay these guys. We want to keep them around. Can't have it both ways. So it's a fun kind of scenario to look at and say which side was right. And I think what I defend the Rams is that they are – building a player-first organization where guys want to come play. So, like, oh, they're going to take care of me as long as I perform. And that's what a lot of organizations, that forward thinking is starting to go. And, you know, to your point, the Giants are still kind of like old school with Dave Gettleman, and I'm sure you've talked about it plenty, but it's finding that forward thinking of how, okay, we want to be player-friendly while still being smart with cap and not – now the Rams were too player-friendly, and now they're screwed for the next 2 years because they have no money to play with. So,
and then, so to that point, I mean, the Giants have gotten a lot better at it. So Soldier's the only one that's really under – salary cap that is killing them and really just crippling them. But again, that's one guy. Everyone else, it's manageable. My issue with the Jets is that all right, they're the Jets. They're not paying anyone else other than Lev Bell. Yeah. All right. Sam Darnold, yes, will have a contract to come up, but he's a quarterback. So if he's your franchise quarterback, you're going to pay him. Everyone else on that team is expendable. They let Robbie Anderson go. They didn't want to pay him. Yeah. My point is, if you don't pay Jamal Adams, who are you going to pay?
Who are they even paying?
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't make any sense. Like, the veteran lineman that you brought in the free agency, like, that's not your team. CJ Mosley, again, that's not an in-house guy. So, and to me, it's one of the first episodes I did about the Jets, but I feel like they get the bad rep because they don't take care of their own. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge part of a successful franchise. Yeah. Mahomes, that's their own. You don't let something like that. Granted, Mahomes is once in a generation, but the point is keep people that you bring in happy. So then this way it kind of trickles down. It goes from the top down that way. And we'll see. The Giants are on the clock with Saquon too. So we'll see how that goes.
That'll be a fascinating contract to see what they value the running back position at. So,
oh my God.
Anyway, I took you down that rabbit hole, but we'll see.
So we only did one safety. I knew we'd get in murky waters with Jamal Adams. I want to tip the cap here. And I think it's actually interesting that the Giants had him play safety for them. So especially in the time that we're in, but we're going to go Emlyn Tunnell, who's a Hall of Famer, the first African-American to play for the Giants, but also the first African-American to be named into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, which is awesome.
Huge. Yeah.
9-time Pro Bowler, 4-time All-Pro, 2-time NFL champ, played 11 seasons with the Giants. If you look up his stats, if you look up his numbers, just at his time, he was the safety position. I mean, that's what you would model it off of. That's what coaches would look up to teach other players on how to play the game and play the position of safety. So, I mean, without him opening the doors for a lot of people and showing people it was possible, not only from the standpoint of the African-American community in the NFL, but just as a whole at the safety position, what he was able to do. I mean, again, a tip of the cap to the old timers, because without them, this shit does not happen. I mean, where the NFL is, if they don't set the tone and just kind of show it how it's supposed to be done, who knows where the hell we'd be right now.
Oh, 100%. I love that. And it's a reason I even thought of at running back. He wasn't good enough to make the list, but I thought of putting Kenny Washington in there, who was the first African-American for the LA Rams, played at UCLA also. One day may have a move play back in like 1944, 45. I mean, everyone talks about Jackie Robinson, and rightfully so. But Kenny Washington was that to the NFL and to the LA market. You mentioned the safety there, being the first guy in the Hall of Fame. Like, it's just so instrumental for the future of our game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, and just look where the safety position is now. I mean, I even joke, I mean, defensive backs in itself. He was the first safety that was African-American to be elected in the Hall of Fame. Think about how many since, you know? I mean, think of Ed Reed. You know, if he's not there, is there guys like Ed Reed? Exactly. So, I mean, that's just transcended beyond levels. And, of course, we're assembling the greatest players, and his numbers back it up and his accolades back it up. But, you know, especially in the time that we're in, I think it's very humbling to see something like that, especially for the Giants organization. I was pleasantly happy to see that he was the first to be into the Hall of Fame, you know, as an African-American.
Yeah. I didn't know that. So that's cool. Yep. So my safeties, for me, it was a three-horse race in L.A. And I got some flack on my show for the guy I left out. It was so hard to choose between the three. So I'll start with the one, and then my last two was the big debate. So I went first UCLA product, Kenny Easley, played for the Seattle Seahawks Hall of Famer, but he was great at UCLA, 3-time All-American. Here were the two stats I thought was awesome because he was a phenomenal safety, probably one of the greatest UCLA players of all time. As a freshman, he had 9 interceptions as a safety, as a freshman. To me, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
The other fun one, and this is all just a folk story. Who knows how true it is? But the story, the legend, if you will, goes he was recruited by 350 universities to play football. I didn't even know there was that many universities. That could totally be bullshit, but I saw that and I was like, got to throw that in there because what kind of folklore is that?
Was it all? Yeah. Was there a specification on D1, D2? I mean, every school in the country, D3 to D1 probably makes up that amount of schools.
Yeah, exactly. It had to just be everyone who got in the mail and overseas and whatever. So Kenny Easley for me was an easy choice. Now the debate between these two was very, very hard. And I ended up going with probably the guy that most people wouldn't. I went with Troy Polamalu. I just think what he did, and you could argue both what he did for the game transcended, but Polamalu with his swagger, with the hair, he was kind of the first safety at USC to really change the position. The other guy I didn't put was Ronnie Lott. Ronnie Lott, obviously, unbelievable. Yeah,
I could see why you got slack.
Because Ronnie Lott was so, so good, but he was a true safety, and he was a hard nose, you know, do not go over the middle safety. But what I loved about Polamalu is he could play in the box. He could play at corner. He could play on the line of freaking scrimmage. He was all over the place. So he was the first kind of safety, at least
over the line of scrimmage.
Over the line of scrimmage. that was just everywhere on the field. And so with how good Ronnie Lott was and how much he probably should be, I went Paul Amala just because of what he did for the position and what he meant to the program. And people always remember Paul Amala as they do Ronnie Lott. It was tough. So you could go 1A, 1A, whatever. But I went Paul Amala.
I wasn't 1,000% certain if we did special teams, but I did it anyways. I did it anyways. No kick returners, no punt returners. That part I don't have. But I do have punters and kickers because they are very important. And I want to start with the Giants punter here. And this is like 7th, 6th grade Steven that always used to love this statistic and having him on our team. So Jeff Fegels is my punter, and he was an ageless wonder. This guy played 21 seasons in the NFL, okay?
That is ageless, yeah.
Two-time Pro Bowler, Super Bowl champ. That part won't wow you. He holds the record for most punts inside the 20-yard line, what you aim for as a punter. He's done it 554 times.
That's unreal.
Mic drop.
That's unreal. Is that a testament to him or a testament to the Giants offense not being able to punch the ball and pass the 50?
You know what? It's actually a testament to the Giants offense not crossing the 50 because then they don't even got to consider it. It makes his job easier. But I will say this. It wasn't every time. It wasn't every time like it being that close. Obviously, it wouldn't be. But I've seen this guy, his backspin, he was – again, I don't know how much he pioneered it, but I know Leckler was right behind him on these numbers, and they were in different generations. But just what he was able to do with the ball as a punter was sick. I mean, just drop shots, basically. Just seeing a ball move the way it did. And you find it more fascinating when you realize he does it on purpose. I think that's the best way to put it. When you see he's actually angling and aiming to do it, you're like, holy shit, that's actually insane.
That's intentional. Yeah, that's a pitching wedge right there.
Especially when you go from Jeff Fegels to Matt Dodge, who's the reason that there's a miracle in the Meadowlands part two, because he couldn't even kick the ball out of bounds at an NFL level. You could appreciate pinning it inside the 2,554 times.
Yeah, that's unreal. That's great. Yeah, it's all beyond. I didn't do a punter kicker, so we can just continue on with your kicker.
And then Lawrence Tynes, just because I hated him a lot when they were playing Green Bay in 07 in the playoff game. And this, again, this is the fandom in you. You're like, dude, it's -2 degrees. Suck it up. Make your field goals. No excuse.
I don't care if it's
38 yards. I don't care if there's frostbite on your foot. We're going to the Super Bowl. But then he made it. And then he made it, and he proved to be clutch from that point on. Very reliable. I like mentioning that I was not a Lawrence Tynes fan for about 2 hours, and then Favre threw a pick in overtime. And I was just like, if this guy misses three, he can't come back.
No.
He can't come back to New York. It's done for him. So it was almost like a benefit of the doubt. But
how nervous. No matter what, if you're kicking the playoffs, you're nervous. But trying to kick to go to the Super Bowl and maybe going 0-3, what was his blood pressure like?
Whew. And then it was so humbling, too, because then the Giants get blessed up. The second time they go to the Super Bowl, the 49ers blew it. I forget who the returner was, but he muffed the punt. He muffed the punt return twice. The second one, the Giants recovered. And Tynes kicked them to the Super Bowl again in that. But my confidence level that second time was way higher than the first time. It was not anywhere close.
Understandably.
But then we could go to head coaches. And so this is another one where the Giants, again, were benefited with some crazy defensive just genes, I guess is what we'll put it as at this point. But head coach, we're going to go Parcells, and defensive coordinator, I'm going Bill Belichick. They got a 30 for 30 on each other. I don't need to go much further. I'm going to make Greg Schiano the special teams coordinator just because I think he did that at Ohio State. I'm sure that's not his actual job title, but we're going to go Schiano, Belichick, Parcells, and just it doesn't get more Jersey than that. It really doesn't get more New York, New Jersey than that. Listen to Parcells and Schiano speak would be the greatest thing before a game or at halftime.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a great trio right there. I had to go for my head coach, Pete Carroll. I mean, you can't argue with what Pete Carroll did at USC and even what he's doing now in Seattle, but a legend in L.A. And, you know, he'd always be welcome back here, even though he kind of left when all those sanctions came. I don't think he was ever like – a lot of times when coaches leave and sanctions come, I feel like a lot of fans blame the coach. Like, oh, wow, you bailed. No one really ever did, Pete. There's like, he got out at the right time. He made the right thing, right business decision to get out of L.A. and go to Seattle. So he's still beloved here.
While we're talking about sanctions, and this is something, and I was going to ask you some L.A. stuff because I know that's pretty much the teams. Those are our list. And again, guys, we're going to put up polls. We're going to We're going to do the work so you guys can vote on it, weigh in, tell us who we missed and all that good stuff. But to the sanctions, Reggie Bush, it was something that was actually recently talked about. I'm sure you mentioned it already before, but you know, how awesome was it to hear that Vince Young was offered that Heisman and he said no, because it's not his. And then the fact that there's now this campaign kind of around that Reggie should get his Heisman back.
Yeah. Oh, Hunter, as he should. I mean, what happened with Reggie, you see a lot of things in sports where guys get suspended and it's due to things that aid their playing ability. What happened with Reggie, you know, we don't have to go down what actually happened, but it was all off the field. You know, school supposedly bought a house for his parents in San Diego or whatever. Had nothing to do with his play on the field. It wasn't taking performance-enhancing drugs. So when you strip someone of a performance thing, he has to get it back. And the fact that, especially now that we see these laws getting passed in New York and California, that players can make money off their likeness, it's super ironic that this happens right when Reggie Bush is accepted back in the USC family. Guy's got to get his Heisman back. He's arguably the top five collegiate player of all time, offensively at least.
So here's the thing with Reggie for me too. And he's such an underrated NFL player. I think if I actually like think back at like one of the all time underrated NFL players, it's him. He was huge on that Saints team.
Yeah.
And he did everything he did for USC and more on that team as well. The punt returns he did, he had an explosive one in the playoffs. I know that sent them pretty much to the ship itself. But he was a running back. They pretty much used him any way they wanted to at running back. I mean, he got a bad rap because he got popped in that game against the Eagles. Yeah. But honestly, that's not Reggie Bush. And I think if you look at his whole body of work, he had just as crazy impressive touchdown runs in the NFL as he did in college. It's just for whatever reason, he was just so good in college. I mean, on another planet that – he obviously didn't live up to that expectation in the NFL, but at the same time, I really do think he was a consummate pro. I think he gets a bad rap, especially with the whole Heisman thing and the things that got linked to him and him getting popped. Reggie Bush goes under the radar way too much, at least in this generation. He was the guy that when you grew up, you were just – he was the highlight tape. He's the highlight tape you watched when you were going on YouTube for the first time looking up football stuff.
Oh, yeah, and I love that you say that about his NFL. I saw a list recently that had ranking the biggest NFL busts of all time, and he was on the list as an NFL bust. Like, yeah, I get it, and you said it. Maybe he didn't live up to that, his hype in college or being drafted number two overall, but he still had a very, very good NFL career. And like you said, he was kind of the jack of all trades. He wasn't your typical – when you think of number two pick, you think of, okay, that's a running back who's going to get me 1,200 yards every season, probably receive 400 to 500 yards. But he did so much more in the special teams game as a decoy. I mean, Deuce McAllister wouldn't have been Deuce McAllister if Reggie Bush wasn't in that backfield also. So
Deuce McAllister caught a second wind during that Super Bowl run. I mean, Deuce was getting up there. Deuce was getting up there. And so he was the perfect complement. And you're right, especially at what the NFL was doing back then. I mean, the style was just completely different. And they had someone like Breeze at quarterback, so they were kind of limited. So the fact that they were able to have two running backs – just kind of deceive is huge. I mean, that's just more of a competitive advantage for the Saints, and it obviously paid off for them.
And I don't think we'd have a Christian McCaffrey or a Saquon Barkley if not a Reggie Bush 10 years ago. He kind of recreated the running back position, and then Saquon, Christian McCaffrey, the other guys have now perfected it into what we see today.
Yeah, and it's funny because you're like second overall, and so Saquon's second overall. Yeah, that's what you think of, a guarantee basically offensive rookie of the year, and he's going to be a 1,000-yard rusher and can do it all. Ricky Williams, you know, we don't want to talk about Ricky, but because, and you know what, let's just talk about it real quick, because I think it's so funny because that's tied to the Saints too. I saw that trade recently and I mean, what a time. What a time. I just wish I was around when these things were going on. I would imagine if Twitter was around when things like this was going on.
I thought it was fake. When I saw it again, what they gave up, I'm like, that has to be a joke. It has to be a meme. There's no way they gave up that much for one player, especially a running back.
We'll never see it again. I've never seen it before that since. Just amazing. It's just amazing top to bottom. And the fact that Mike Ditka was involved in it and like hearing him try to justify it and explain is just, they have like a press conference of him talking about it, and he's just in Ditka fashion, smoking a cigar, just with no fucks given. Just like, we got our guy. That's all that matters. We got our
guy. All we needed. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What a time. That's crazy, man. It was nuts.
So one more thing too. I'm curious on the Rams running back situation. I know this could lead us down a rabbit hole, but in the midst of some dynasty drafts, a lot of people are high on Cam Akers, as they should be, because Florida State was awful this year, and he was very good despite that. But You got another young running back that you were invested in kind of last year in Darrell Henderson Jr. You got some other guys on that team. I'm just curious on, is it Akers' team? How's the dynamic of the running back situation without Gurley looking for the Rams this season?
Cam Akers is the guy. If you're looking dynasty draft, if you're talking specifically fantasy, for sure, well, he's the guy.
Yeah, he's redraft too. Malcolm Brown's still there. He's never going away. When Gurley was there, Malcolm Brown never went away. So I'm just curious, is it we giving the keys to the kingdom to the rookie right off the rip?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fact that he was their first pick taken overall. I know he went in the second round, but he was their first pick after just, you know, trading or not trading, but releasing Todd Gurley. And a lot of people are like, okay, they're going to go a different way. And they went running back again. Like, well, why did you get rid of Gurley? But I think too, you know, Malcolm Brown's a guy that, you know, he's a bulldozer, he's a bowling ball. He's going to be some third down possessions. He might vulture some touchdowns. But that's all he is. He's going to average 200 yards a season, maybe get a couple touchdowns. Darrell Henderson, which has been a big debate in LA here a lot, and a lot of people I've talked to, but when he was drafted last year, he was drafted in the third round as a complement to, at the time, Gurley. He was never drafted to be the three down back, never drafted to be the guy in LA. He was a guy who's a slasher who can break the game open with big runs, but he's a guy that's going to get 5 to 10 touches a game. That's all he's ever going to be. I mean, we might see a game or here where he gets 20 touches, 18 touches, but that's not who he is. He's a 5 to 10 touch guy. So this is Cam Akers' team. He's going to come in right off the bat. He's going to garner a lot of the respect, garner a lot of the attention. But I think he'll thrive in it. You know, freshman all ACC at Florida State. And obviously we've seen what he can do with very little help around him. The offensive line is going to be better in LA. Sean McVay is getting back to what he does. We're going to see a lot of 12 personnel. So anyway, I'm ranting, but I think Cam Akers is going to do good things.
No, I love the rant. And I'm going to get you in another rant too, because it's funny that both LA teams have a similar situation. So over in Chargers land, they didn't want essentially Melvin Gordon anymore. They didn't want that problem anymore. So they move on. Now you got Eckler there. You got some other pieces there too. Again, it's a similar situation. You got a guy who was there, who's seen some production. Then you got younger guys underneath. Justin Jackson's kind of, they've been waiting for him to do anything, and he's been teetering. Then you also got a young guy. I know there's a UCLA guy trying to make the team, and Josh Kelly there, who's, you know, had sparing success last year. Do you believe the whole Eckler project can work? Can Eckler really be that kind of Patriots type running back that's undersized, that's just really that scat back, and can manage to use his receiving on all three downs? Is that just a plan for the Chargers? Are they going to ride off into the sunset with him?
You know, I do believe it can work. It's just going to look different than what people think. I mean, I don't know if we're talking specifically fantasy or just success
in general. I mean, Eckler will have fantasy success for sure. I'm just like, from a football standpoint, because like we're talking about here, that's what the NFL has become. Try to find a younger running back that can really just do it all, and then we can plug in some guys. Well, what the Chargers are doing is, like, we have some younger guys, but we have this dude in Eckler that we're hoping can just do it all despite the physical stature of him. I just find him so amazing sometimes. I was a big fan of him last year. It's just kind of defies the odds, and I'm just curious if, like, that's really the feeling over there as well. Like, we're going to ride with Eckler, and I think this thing can be successful.
Yeah, no, I think they truly believe in him. The offense is going to look very different. They kind of adjusted the offense last year, almost pinpoint. Obviously, Ken Wisenhunt started as the OC. Shane Steichen took over. We're going to see a lot more of what Anthony Lynn ran when he was in Buffalo. Obviously, Tyrod Taylor is his quarterback yet again. So we'll see a lot of that more. Putting an emphasis on the run game, which I think benefits Eckler. But something a lot of people don't know too is, last year he was learning a lot of routes and the receiving it on the fly. Because if people don't remember a lot, but Melvin Gordon was very involved in the passing game also. That's what made him actually a very good running back. He was obviously drafted high out of Wisconsin, but he was very involved in the running game, in the passing game. So when he decided to hold out, all of a sudden Eckler gets all these extra duties given to him. He's learning routes on the fly. He's running between the tackles a lot more, which he did very well. But then I'm probably higher on than a lot of people, but I'm huge on Joshua Kelly at UCLA. I mean, he was the, I think, sixth ever back-to-back 1,000-yard rusher in UCLA history. Kind of battled some injuries, but came back strong. Huge character guy. So I think he's going to be a huge compliment to Eckler, even more than Justin Jackson.
Yeah.
But I think Eckler can do great things. It's just not going to be that three-down style that people are used to. It's going to be, like you mentioned, kind of a – not necessarily a scat back, because he can run in between the tackles.
For sure.
He's a – big dude for his size, but I think the experiment's going to work, and they're obviously going to save a lot of money doing it.
Well, I was just curious too, because with that, you know, with Joshua and Justin, it just, the way it looks, it's almost like typically what the NFL, what they would do is have those guys try to somehow manage to win the first down carry or the second down carry, and then Eckler will take over from there essentially for the drive or whatever it be. You know what I'm saying? Is Eckler going to be the between the tackle runner when you have to go down on first and 10 to run the first play of the season? Is Eckler going to be down there to get the power or run? And I think he did it enough last year that you can be confident about it. I just don't always know if that necessarily rides out a 16 game season. I just, you know, it's tough, dude. It's tough on a running back sometimes, especially in that size. That's the point of it. It's not even just being an undersized running back. It's really just the natural wear and tear for someone at that size to run it between the tackles. It's look, we were talking about taking on fullbacks before. Getting hit by a linebacker is no easier. It's no easier. That is
or a crashing safety, a crashing Jamal Adams. But one thing I think too, and last thing I'll say, unless you have more on it, but a lot of people, and not that they're wrong by any means, but a lot of people still kind of look at running back efficiency and running back tandems, if you will, as a first and second down back and a third down back. Mm-hmm. To me, I think a lot of these teams, and the Rams kind of showed this a lot too, it's more about number of touches per game, not necessarily – they want running backs. Obviously, each running back has a specific skill set, but they want running backs that can run on all their plays, not necessarily, okay, this play is only designed for Eckler. He's the only one that can do it. We're only going to run it on third down. So they're looking more, okay, we want Austin Eckler to get his 18 to 20 touches. We want Justin Jackson to get 3 to 4. We want Joshua Kelly to get 5 to 10. And then they'll situationally put them in to plays where they can utilize that and still get their touches while maintaining their health throughout the season, as opposed to, okay, it's first down. This is Justin Jackson. Okay, second down, Joshua Kelly. Third down, Austin Eckler. And I think the NFL is evolving away from that. And I think LA, at least the Rams, have shown that. And I think the Chargers, you'll see that a lot more this year too.
Yeah,
just my opinion, but that's what I think.
No, absolutely. And I think that's where the NFL is going too. But it's funny because it's just more traditional what you would see more. It's just what you'd see normally. You know, they just try to sometimes not – make a player fit the scheme. They try to put the player like in their skill set in the right position to succeed, if that makes sense. You don't necessarily always build around it unless you're fully invested in it. So like, I think and a guy like Joshua Kelly, it's like, if they can end up doing that with him and then moving Eckler to third down, if it happens to work and it flows that way, I think they would just be happy. They'd be like, great. You know, that works in our favor. We can do more with it, but it won't be set in stone by anyone.
Well, and how many times as a fan, it can be the most frustrating thing I don't understand. You're third and goal on the 1 yard line and you have your 5-7. I've seen the Broncos do with Phillip Lindsay, saw the Giants do with Wayne Gallman. You have all these big backs, third and goal on the one, and you put your 5-7 guy back there. I'm like, what do you, it's because he's truly coaching. Maybe it's them being they're blinded by their pride, but they think that their play calling is good enough that any player should be able to do it. And so I don't think they necessarily call based on what size is.
That was my biggest issue with Pat Shurmur. Not even the third and one runs, just play calling in the goal line. But it's funny because coaches aren't off the hook either. And I mean, someone like Freddie Kitchens, I think that's a big part of why he lost his job this year. I mean, the Browns were the worst at it. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how some teams, and the Giants at least get points. They won't go for it on fourth down. That's the more frustrating part when you're inside the 20 and you settle for three. It's like, we should have a script. We should have plays and personnel ready for a situation like this, where the Browns were, they would have the plays, but then they'd fall short and then they'd start to run out of plays and they'd try to throw the ball up to Jarvis and Odell and you waste two downs.
Yeah.
You have Chubb and Hunt. It's like, you have all these people, but what play are you calling? And then before you know it, Kitchens out of town, because that is the most important thing. No one gives a shit if you could go 90 yards on a drive. If you do not score a touchdown, no one will remember the drive and no one's going to really care. I mean, that's the NFL. That's just the name of the game's points. Your Broncos are trying to match that in that division. I think they realize they don't have a choice. You might as well just draft all offense.
Yeah.
We're going to have Mahomes in our division for 10 more years. So what are we going to do?
Exactly. That's it. You can have 500 yards, maybe you got 6 points. Not going to matter much.
Yeah. Your thoughts of Mahomes never leaving the AFC West?
Well, I mean, as a Bronco fan, it sucks. The guy's so good. I think where you try to find the silver lining as a person has to face Mahomes twice a year, and it's that contract's so big that it's going to be, in my opinion, I know the cap's going to go up eventually, but it's going to be hard for them to really build it. You look at their team right now, they have so many good players at every position, and a lot of those players too are still on their rookie deals. Tyreek Hill, Chris Jones, obviously, who probably won't be there. He's already talked about it. If he's not getting what he wants, he's out. Yeah. So 5 years from now, that Chiefs team is still going to be competitive because of Mahomes. Having a quarterback that good, they will always be a contender. but you're going to see a lot of up and down because they're not going to be able to sign play. I was talking to someone today on Twitter and they're like, well, I'm sure when the time comes, he'll just restructure so that they can build a team again. I'm like, you're telling me a guy that just signed his contract yesterday and you're already banking on him restructuring so they can rebuild their team?
Restructuring, 450 guaranteed.
Yeah.
That's guarantee money. I mean, he can restructure the back end $50 million, but what's that really going to do for you over a 10-year span? That's $5 million each year.
In 2027, his salary is $50 million. I don't care how much the cap is up. You're not having a lot of talent around him if you're playing one guy $50 million.
I made the joke. I said that the concession stands in Kansas City are going to be the first ones to take a hit. They're just going to start at the – just you got to start somewhere. You know, you got to go bottom down souvenir shops. Start with the little things.
Things
no one will really notice. Just make one general big souvenir shop. Close all the other ones. You cut down on that. I mean, because you got to start cutting costs. You're paying $500 million to one person. I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's crazy. And on his side, and I don't know if you think this, but to me it was kind of – and I guess when we look at the numbers, it was like 450 guaranteed. I guess that changes things. Before the numbers were out, I was like, from a player side, I feel like it's smarter to sign a 3 to 4 year contract. And then when the QB market resets yet again with Deshaun Watson, with Dak Prescott, then you one up then instead of being locked in here. But I guess.
Oh, and by the way, as a Giant fan, as a Giant podcast, I've been beating this drum for months. I cannot wait. I know they franchise tagged Dak. After seeing the Mahomes contract, Jerry Jones is probably biting his fingernails off. Like, we got to cut him now. We can't keep him on this because it's coming. If you pay Dak Prescott that contract, that's when this all really starts to look wishy-washy. That's when you start to actually see that you cannot – this is not how you structure a team. That's why, I mean, we've talked about this before. We talk about it during the draft. The time to win is when your quarterback's on rookie deals. And this is why. They end up being your highest paid player. But now if they're your highest paid player and they're making $400 to $500 million, we're not talking about $100 million anymore. That is a substantial amount of money.
Yeah. Well, Goff signed his $136 million deal and everyone went nuts. That's looking like a huge bargain now. They got him on the cheap. Crazy.
And it's so crazy too, because there's a reason why. So you compare these to baseball contracts. That's what they say. Well, Trout deserves this money, all this yada, yada. But baseball, you could still get away with it. Granted, there's just as many positions, but not really. NFL, 22 guys, offense, defense, even the special, they all pretty much matter. You really can't.
Yeah.
Paying a home run hitter in baseball $300 million so that he can DH and just do that job is substantially different where football, I mean, baseball, there's injuries too and all that. It's just, it's an accident waiting to happen sometimes, whether it's you're pissing off guys like Chris Jones, who's an all pro talent, or it doesn't necessarily always sound as good as it does on the day you sign it.
And
Mahomes deserves it, but. Yeah.
And baseball's cap is a bunch of baloney because they can just go over it if they really want to. Whereas the NFL, it's a hard cap. You're capped off. You're stuck.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely.
You're gonna have a roster of 45 players if you go over it.
But yeah, that was only one thing on Twitter too I saw today. They're just like, oh, who deserves in the MLB? Who's gonna make $400 million? This and I feel like we always knew this time was coming where contracts were gonna shoot to this point, but I still like can't see it. Like that's just not how it works. Even Eli, I remember Eli was he was making bank and he was the highest paid quarterback for a little bit. But like you said, how do you even reset the QB market at this point? How is that even possible?
I know.
Like, where do you even go? Where do you even go to reset it?
The last thing to really think about, too, is, you know, the Patriots, who have been a dynasty for 16 years or whatever. And I haven't looked at the exact contract numbers, but I know pretty factually that Tom Brady was either never or rarely the highest paid quarterback.
He's
always
not making over 20 mil.
There was years he was making 12 to 14 mil because he knew that that's what it took to build a championship team. And say what you want about the guy. I'm not a Brady guy. I'm not a Brady fan. I'm definitely not a Patriots fan by any means. But that's how they've been continually the AFC favorite and the Super Bowl contender every year because they never had a top five paid quarterback. And when's the last time you can remember a team in the Super Bowl that had a top five pick? Not when, just in the Super Bowl. I can't remember one recently.
And that's why you can't even – and I talked about this as well. You can't be mad sometimes, and I talk about this with Jamal Adams leaving too. You can't be mad at a guy if he's done his part of not taking money and feels like he's deserved more. If you're not necessarily paying that with Brady, he wants to be considered the highest paid player at his position or one of them, you know, before Mahomes, to make 20 mil, 25 mil a year for the last couple of years of his career. It's well-deserved. If you're the Pats, obviously they don't want to pay that. But Pats fans getting all salty about it, and I highly doubt you'll really see it, but a lot of them will make the comment, oh, he left for the money. I don't blame a player that leaves for money, especially in that situation. And I mean, Jamal Adams is different, but again, if he's open, if there's an open relationship there and he's willing to work with you and has tried to work with you and you still kind of lowball him, all doors are off. At that point, the owners are going to look out for themselves. How can you get mad at a player for looking out for himself too? And again, fans don't always do that, but I tend to look at it from that side nowadays, especially with this amount of fucking money going around. It's, Jesus.
Yeah, you have to. You have to.
Crazy. But all right, Ryan, that is it. That was awesome. That was our greatest LA and New York football teams. We may have a bunch of brackets from all over the world at some point. We might even get rugby sevens teams at some point. Who knows?
Oh, yeah.
Size of the Kiwis against the Giants. We'll see, but we're going to pull this stuff. You'll see it on the Twitters. You'll see it. You'll see it on other websites. We'll promote it. We'll post it. Ryan, anything for the people before I let you go?
No, man. Thanks for having me on. That was fun. I'm glad we were able to get together a LA versus New York kind of thing, East Coast, West Coast. And yeah, we'll definitely see through the continuing drags of the offseason. Maybe we can get another couple cities involved.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be sure to just chime in. I can join in on the Zoom, whatever you decide to do. If it's just LA versus someone else, and I'll just over the top talk shit about the Giants. Just about the defense. The offense, I feel like there's going to be some cities that go toe-to-toe. The defense, again, your defensive line was very good. We'll see what the people think. But okay. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to separate these teams. Again, you could follow Ryan. He's also a part of the Believe Podcast Network, the LA Football Pod. I believe the Twitter handle is just that, LA Football Pod, correct? Or LA Football Network?
The main account is LAFB Network, or my personal is Ryan Dyrud, LAFB. So.
Fantastic. It's not the NY Football Pod like myself, but hey, I tell you three times a show, follow me anyways. Always appreciated. Same to you, Ryan. Always appreciated. Thanks for the idea. Thanks for coming on the show. Thank you.
It was a blast, man. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always, man. See ya.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.